where the sun never shines. You'll shiver when the cold wind blows. There's a grave in the pines where the sun never shines. There's a grave that's shaded with the pines.
On the Slay Queens podcast, we take a deep dive into the dark side of the rainbow.
This isn't just a cheesy catchphrase. It is a note to remember that the topics we discuss can be very graphic and lurid in nature. Listener discretion has been advised. Hi, everybody.
Hello, hello.
And welcome back.
Welcome back to
the Slay Queens podcast.
Yes. Welcome back to that.
Hello.
And what is it that we do here?
Something
very queer.
Like usually every day of my life, honey. You know, we dive into something.
It's a deep, deep
dive. It's a deep dive.
Yes, yes.
Into that dark side
of something very queer.
Oh, it's probably the rainbow.
It's the rainbow.
I love the rainbow.
The dark side of the rainbow. Yes. Welcome back, everybody, to the Slay Queens podcast.
Yes.
Where we do take that deep dive into the dark side of the rainbow.
Side note. I don't know if I've ever said this on the pod, but I think I've told you. Do you know when I was a kid, like, your parents always had, like, if someone's going to come pick you up, you need to know the passcode, like, because we didn't have cell phones back
okay,
then,
yeah,
you know, that
yeah,
kind of thing?
Yeah.
It was like, okay, if this guy says, I'm your uncle, and I'm picking you up from school, your mom Lisa sent me, be like, okay, well, what's the password? Because I won't make anyone pick you up with do you know what our password was?
I'm intrigued, no.
Rainbow. I didn't make that up. She set me up.
I was going to say, is this an instance where we could argue that it's nurture versus nature that made you a queer person?
I mean, I think it had part to do with, like, the fact that I would only wear boys' clothes at that age, too, but yeah.
Mamas always know, so
isn't
maybe
that funny?
Yeah, maybe it was something subconscious.
I think so.
For her, yeah.
isn't that funny little anecdote about my life?
That is a cute little side note. And hi, Ashley's mom.
Yeah,
I think she listens. She listens, right?
She does.
Yeah. So welcome back, Ashley's mom, and
everybody else.
Everyone that I am going to make efforts to start referring to in general as the fan folks.
As the folks, yes.
Because, you know, other podcasts have just that, like, general term for the, like, true fans, you
sure.
know, the diehard fans. And I have a tendency to say the kings, queens, and folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody could just be the fan folks,
yeah.
right?
The Slay folks.
So we're going to try to incorporate that terminology a little bit more.
Yes.
But
I like that.
Welcome back to this very special episode.
It is a special episode.
We are celebrating today.
We are.
And I just want to start by saying happy anniversary, Ashley.
Happy anniversary. I'm so glad to be here with you.
If we have, once again, because we often preface with this information, if we have looked at the calendar appropriately
yes.
and been good adult people, we have planned for this episode to come out the week that we will be celebrating our 1 year anniversary as the Slay Queens podcast.
One whole year.
Yay. Now, we unfortunately, because of 2020 and the shitstorm that has been and the quarantine and the pandemic, we don't exactly have a year's worth of episodes, but chronologically, this will be
We've
been together for a year doing this amazing thing, being on this amazing journey with all of you amazing folks.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you all for being here.
Yes.
Thank you all for sticking it out with us. And hopefully next year, things will just be that much better.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll get to meet people and stuff. You know,
absolutely.
The things we had planned before with the conventions and all that, but life changes.
Yeah, some things are beyond our control.
Yeah, so.
Rainbow star,
yeah,
shall
rainbow
we?
Star, that's right.
All right, rainbow because we're queer, star because we're giving. Shout outs, thank yous, making announcements or acknowledgements and giving recommendations. First and foremost, I want to shout out a gentleman who is a friend of mine by the name of Ryan Land. He was the original person to suggest the story that I will be discussing today. So thank you very much, Ryan, and we'll give you all more information about that in just a few minutes. I do want to say thank you for the 5-star rate and review on Apple Podcasts that was given to us by screen name Maddie Kinks. Thank you so much, Maddie. And I want to make an acknowledgement/announcement that is also relevant to my recommendation.
I love that. Okay.
All right. So, you know how I previously discussed, I think more than once, but definitely when we did our collaboration with the Queers for Fears podcast mm-hmm. about how my pet peeve is that successful TV shows and successful movies that feature queer relationships
yep.
only feature relationships that in the end are unsuccessful in some sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have to correct myself. in the fact that the queer relationship featured in Schitt's Creek ended very positively.
This is serendipitous, right? Mm-hmm. I literally just finished season 6. Like, I finally wrapped myself to do it. And I cried.
Yeah.
I don't even want to admit how many times. Like, I was a blubbering mess. And Sarah's like, are you all right? I'm like, I'm not.
Same girl. That's exactly how I felt.
This is too much for me. Oh, so good. Okay, yeah. And I was going to bring that up too. So that's so funny. Yeah, awesome.
I didn't realize that on my own. It's not like I had this like moment of clarity where I was like, oh my goodness, I was wrong. I was watching, and this rolls into my recommendation, I was watching the documentary now that's available on Netflix, Best Wishes, Warmest Regards, A Schitt's Creek Farewell. Mm-hmm. It's a documentary style. They essentially talk about the show's inception, how they cast the characters that they cast, or the actors to play the characters that they cast, and then how it ended. And at some point throughout the course of that documentary, they pointed out the fact that this was a relationship, a gay relationship, a homosexual couple that was happy and healthy and successful in the end, that was super popular, super supported by the general public and the fans of the show in general. And it checked me in that argument that I have, and that pet peeve that I have, that those happy gay relationships don't exist
ever
in that realm.
Well, that's the thing too. And I remember sitting and watching the ending with Sierra and being like, holy shit, they got away with it.
They got away with it. Yes.
But here's the thing. I always knew that Schitt's Creek wasn't going to end tragically, right? Like, I think I would have figured that out by now, but like, I just never... It never dawned on me because I hadn't finished it. But yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's awesome. I think we're going to be David and Patrick for Halloween.
That's so amazing.
I already dressed like David, so it's so easy.
I love the couple's ideas for costumes. You and I had previously discussed some ideas that the two of you were kicking around, and Hunter and I are going to do. And by the time people hear this episode, it will have already been done.
Yeah.
But Hunter and I are going to do.
I thought of that too. I'm like, well, this is going to be in November, but it will.
Gomez and Morticia, but I'm going to do a very gender non-conforming Morticia Gomez with a black beard and like a red lip.
It's going to be so hot. I'm so excited.
I'm really looking forward to it. And I have gotten a lot of great information from a lot of drag artists and people who have helped kind of guide me to pull this off.
When I did Bride of Chucky last year, and I like had to glue my eyebrows down and like draw those lines on, girl, I watch nothing but drag videos. Like, how do you guys do this? Because to me, like, how do y'all do it? It did not look good on me. I did not do a good job. Elmer's glue and everything, but girl, no.
The most useful information I have found with regard to kind of the biggest project for me, which is going to be coloring my beard, I got from a drag queen, Helvetica, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Helvetica, who is a bearded queen who colors her beard to match her wig traditionally.
I love that. Yes. Now I have to follow this person.
And it was exactly what I needed. So I feel very confident going into my look. And I will post pictures. So hopefully everybody will see it. And hopefully it will be as good as...
As you hope.
As we hope. Okay. Do you have anything else to contribute to the Rainbow Star this week?
Oh, no. One thing. Just one thing. Because you know how this happens all the time. And I'm only pulling this up because I want to make sure I get the name of the show right.
Okay.
You know, it always happens all the time where like... We talk about a subject and then like a few days later or whatever, like I'm a witch. I like manifested into being something I'm going to now decide to watch somehow. So I was looking through Hulu, trying to find some new docuseries to watch. I was in that kind of mood. And this one is called Kids Behind Bars, Life or Parole. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. So I had talked about previously, I believe, in the Cassie Jo Stoddart case, where because they were minors, the boys were both eligible to have a retrial, because in 2012, I think it was like Mississippi. There was a Mississippi case, I think, that started it. I might be wrong about that. It starts with an M. They said that, you know, putting a juvenile in prison for life or a death sentence is unconstitutional. And I didn't know why. So I kind of wanted to watch this based on that, because there's over 2,000 individuals who have now been in prison like for 20, 30 years that like maybe they've changed, because as a teenager, what they really do harp on in each episode, and different psychiatrists too, right? Like, it's not just the same people talking every time, which I love. It's case by case. It's always going to be different. That your frontal lobe, where the decision making takes place, is not developed as a teenager. So if you're in this unfortunate circumstance, if you're abused, if you're beaten, if you're kicked out of your home and you have nowhere to go, like one case, this kid literally met a group of kids at the mall. They said, we'll give you a ride with us. Just don't trip on how we get the car. They straight up killed someone. And now he's been in prison for 24 years.
Holy shit.
He knows four languages. He is a very, like, lack of a better term, like, handsome guy, like, just well put together. Just, I think at the end of the day, he's probably so depressed because he just knows, like, this is just what life is at this point. Like, yeah. I made a mistake and now I'm here. And two of those boys, like, got a plea deal, which is insane. So, yes, that was a really long description, but it's
a great show.
It's a great show.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. All right, so before we get started, should we take just a quick break?
Yeah, we'll take a little break.
All right, we'll come right back, and we have a special story.
Special story.
Okay, we are back. Do you want to do it?
Back again. Did I do it?
Yeah, you did it. I'll do it next time. We'll do a little trade-off.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Okay, so what we have decided to do in order to commemorate our anniversary for our special anniversary episode, some people out in the queendom, out in the fandom, have picked up on the fact that the first episodes that we recorded aren't actually out there for people to listen to.
And how do you know? Do we say, like, it's episode, like...
I think in the very beginning we were saying, welcome back to episode so and such.
Okay, that must be why.
So the true diehard fans
It just dawned on me how people knew.
Yeah, have just realized that not all of our episodes are out there for people to listen to. And the reason being is because it's just like starting anything new. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not your best work. And we didn't get the best sort of feedback with regard to our first, like, four or five episodes. So we just archived those.
Yeah. To be fair, we started recording in my apartment, which was like floor to ceiling windows and like just glass everywhere and openness, which was wonderful if you're not recording a podcast. But we didn't know those things, you know?
We were learning. We didn't know how to edit ourselves. So every like bit of research that we did turned into like at least one or two episodes. Yeah. And didn't really know how to edit ourselves, didn't really know the best way to tell a story.
Exactly.
So we archived those first few stories and said that we were going to take the opportunity in the future to retell those stories. Yes. So what we are doing is just that.
Exactly that.
I am going to retell the story, which I think ended up being our fourth and fifth episodes. And Ashley is going to retell the story that was, I believe, originally our third episode that we had recorded.
I need to say this up front, though, because in all fairness, you're the one who wrote this script. And like, I was sick that week. So I think it's the only time I was ever not on the podcast when you did record it. So, of course, I read the script and I edited it myself and all of that. However, you're going to die when you hear, like, how I didn't know how to pronounce this person's name.
Okay.
I'm like, is Wayne just fucking with me at this point?
Probably was. That would be great. You just ruined a whole idea that would have been the best prank ever. I could be like, Ashley, I researched this really amazing case. I want you to tell it. And, like, I just send it to you. And
I think after, though, doing the Hiroshi Meiwa, and if you see how that's spelled, I think that I've already screwed myself enough, you know?
I get that.
If I can do that, I can do anything, I feel.
We just want everyone to know that we're trying our best.
Yes, we are. That's exactly what I'm saying. Disclosure. Yeah. That's right, right?
All right. So we are retelling today the story of Bob Berdella, the Kansas City Butcher, a.k.a. The Collector. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to hear this one again?
I'm honestly so excited for it.
You said this before when we were on break, and I felt the same way. I don't know that I expressed that at the time. This is actually one of the favorite stories that we've done in research, even though it wasn't maybe the best episode that we originally produced.
So. Yeah, I'm glad we're choosing to do this one because of that reason, because it's one of my favorites.
And it has actually been a suggestion by a couple of the listeners who routinely reach out and give us praises suggest cases.
Well, here you go, everyone.
Here you go. We're going to talk about Bob Berdella today. So, first and foremost, the early years. Robert Andrew Berdella Jr. was born January 31st, 1949 in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. So shout out to Ohioans. We're always pretty fucked up.
I have a friend who's actually from Cuyahoga Falls.
Two parents, Robert Andrew Berdella Sr. and Mary Louise Huffman Berdella. Bob was the oldest of two children. The community would describe them as a, quote, average Catholic family, conservative and normal, air quotes normal, right?
Like going to mass
every Sunday. Those closer to the family, however, would report that Bob Sr. had obvious preferential feelings towards his younger son, Craig. Craig is described as having been athletic, good at sports, and a real man's man, as opposed to Bob Jr., who was non-athletic, eccentric, and speaking with a slight lisp, also wearing Coke bottle eyeglasses. I think we all knew a kid like that at some point in school. Well, if you weren't, maybe that kid yourself.
That's fair. Well, and it all, I remember when you first told the story, too, thinking I was doing a direct comparison to, like, Johnny Cash and his brother.
Yeah.
Like, how they tell that story, yeah. Right? Which I know you can empathize
with. I can absolutely, yes. Bob Sr. viewed Bob Jr.'s non-athleticism as a point of failure, and because of this was oftentimes emotionally and physically abusive towards the boy, disciplining him with lashes from a leather strap. In addition to an unhappy home life, teenage Bob would realize that he was gay and be subjected to merciless bullying at school. And I mean, you have to consider that this was Ohio in the 1960s.
Even Ohio now.
Even Ohio, Ohio now, falls. Absolutely.
Like, you know where that is? Like, that's north.
but especially in the 1960s, I can't imagine what sort of torment he experienced. Mm-hmm. When Bob Jr. was 16 years old, his father would die of a sudden heart attack on Christmas Day, 1965, when he was only 39 years old. Mary Louise would later remarry, much to the disapproval of Bob Jr., because he felt as though this was an act of betrayal towards his father. And this was the inception of something that we haven't used term-wise in quite a while, but my side note here was why. You know, why was he so upset that his mother, or he felt as though his mother was betraying this man who was so awful to him? Mm-hmm. Did he have daddy issues? Was this daddy issuesness?
Daddy issuesness. That's so fun. Like, we had a lot of cases, I think, at the beginning where that just became a thing for us.
We were discussing daddy issuesness.
Yeah. Hashtag daddy issuesness.
Yeah, we haven't brought that up in a while.
Well, that's our thing again.
Yeah, I'm going to try to.
That definitely could be why. Like, he had this, like, affinity for his father, even though he was such this horrible man.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So, ponder that one. All right. The resentment Bob would ultimately have for his mother would cause him to become increasingly more withdrawn and distanced from the rest of his family. All right. So moving on into Bob's adult life. Attending and ultimately dropping out of the Kansas City Art Institute, young Bob would decide that cooking was his passion and begin pursuing opportunities to work as a full-time chef. He would actually become accomplished in this industry, working for several successful restaurants and country clubs in the Kansas City area, even going on to join the local chefs association, helping with training classes for those who were interested in the culinary arts. During that time, Bob's artistic interests evolved into an eclectic collection. That's kind of a difficult term, an eclectic collection of antiques, jewelry, and oddities from all around the world, things that many would describe as dark or occult-like. Ultimately, these items would turn into a full-time business for Bob when he rented a booth space at the Westport Flea Market, opening a booth called Bob's Bazaar, and he began selling these things to the general public. In addition to his professional successes, Bob Berdella would develop a respected personal reputation within most of the general community, being described as a helpful, civic-minded individual for his work organizing anti-crime and neighborhood watch groups.
I think at that point I made the BTK reference for the first time, too.
I think you did, yeah.
Because, like, you know, same kind of idea, right?
Yep.
Except he didn't have, like, a crazy store that he sold things at. He just had a different job. Anyways, go on.
He would even act as a mentor and counselor to troubled young men who struggled with drug and alcohol addiction, to the extent that some local judges and parole boards would refer some of their worst cases to Bob to really help, quote, straighten those men out, which is ironic in so many ways.
Isn't that ironic?
Everyone is going to understand here in a bit. At the time, Bob was out as a gay man and had a good reputation, or seemingly had a good reputation, with the homosexual community of Kansas City. He was known to help out down-on-their-luck young gay men. He was known to help them make honest money by doing odd jobs in or around his home or at his business. All in all, Bob seemed to have overcome any of the troubles that he had experienced within his youth and during his college years and had become an upstanding citizen. But as we all know,
we wouldn't
too
be
well,
here.
As we have known for a year now, things are not always as they seem. We wouldn't be discussing Bob today if that were the case, right? All right, so let's talk about a gentleman by the name of Christopher Bryson, shall we?
We shall.
All right. On the Saturday before Easter, 1988, a meter man working outside the residence, working outside a residence near 4315 Charlotte Street in Kansas City, would be approached by a young man wearing a dog collar attached to a dog leash. Only wearing a dog collar attached to a dog leash. Mm-hmm. That man would identify himself as 22-year-old Christopher Bryson and state that he was in need of help. The meter man would take Bryson to a nearby house and ask that homeowner to contact the police and emergency services. Because, of course, this was long before the day of cell phones and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Officer Troy Cole would be the first to arrive on the scene. Bryson, who was a sex worker, fearing that the police would not take his complaints as seriously if he divulged the fact to them that he was a sex worker, would initially report that he had been hitchhiking 4 days prior, so it was early Tuesday of that week, around 1 o'clock in the morning, when a man stopped to give him a ride. Once inside the vehicle, the man would introduce himself as Bob and ask if Bryson would be interested in accompanying him back to his home to hang out and party. The young man said that he agreed to this. After arriving to Bob's home, he would tell Bryson that he was the owner of two large, vicious chow dogs, and in order to not provoke the dogs, that they should go upstairs, drink and watch TV in what he called his party room, which, of course, would keep the dogs downstairs and keep them safe from these angry canines, right?
Right.
Again, the young man said that he agreed to this. As he began to ascend the staircase, Bryson states that he felt a sharp pain across the back of his head. And he would later wake up bound by all fours to a bed in one of the secluded rooms upstairs. Also upon waking, he would find that he was naked, all but for a dog collar and a dog leash. Over the course of the next 4 days, Bryson would be sedated with animal tranquilizers. He would be beaten, he would be brutalized, and he would be raped. He would be sodomized, of course. All while the man he knew only at the time as Bob would take Polaroid pictures of all the torture and all the crimes that he was inflicting upon him. The tortures that the young man would suffer included some of the following: electric shocks in excess of 7,000 volts that were delivered via alligator clamps placed on the nipples and genitalia.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Ammonia rubbed into his eyes in attempts to blind Bryson and hinder any attempts that he might make to run away. This is the one that always, for some reason, just freaks me out the most. I don't know if it's because I have a hearing issue myself, but the man placed caulking or sealant inside the ears in order to attempt to deafen the man and keep him from knowing when Bob was approaching or if there were anybody else in the house, et cetera, et cetera.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Also injecting drain cleaner into the larynx or the voice box in attempts to mute the victim so that he couldn't call out for help. Also injecting random household cleaners and liquids into the skin at various points throughout the whole body. Bryson would go on to advise that on the fourth day, after having loosely learned Bob's schedule and thinking that the man had gone to work for the day, he would manage to free one of his hands from the binding, retrieve a book of matches that had accidentally been left out on a bedside tray, and burn the remaining bindings to free himself from the bed. Bryson, fearing that if he went downstairs to the first level of the home, he would be attacked by the dogs that Bob had previously mentioned, found a window, jumped from the second story to gain his freedom, actually breaking one of his feet in the process. Despite this injury, he would run into the street and flag down the first person he could find. It should also be noted that at some point throughout the course of this recount of the events, Bryson would come clean to Officer Cole that he had actually met Bob, not as a hitchhiker, but rather offering his services as a sex worker. Troy Cole is quoted as saying that his initial feelings were that this was, quote, a couple of homosexuals who had had a lover's quarrel, and he was tempted to just let the situation play itself out. Or his second thought was that this was, quote, some weird gay S&M sex thing gone wrong. By the time the second officer would arrive on the scene, the house Bryson escaped from would be identified as belonging to Robert Andrew Berdella.
None other than.
None other than. That's what I was trying to say.
None other than.
And it just was not working out for me.
I thought so. I was just helping.
Yeah, I appreciate you.
And I was going to say at the beginning of this, like when you mentioned, like he walked up to, or ran rather, to a meter maid.
Hobbled.
if you will. Yeah. He was Eileen. He obviously was not just wearing a dog collar. Like, I mean, yes, physically speaking, clothing wise, that's all he had on. But like, you can imagine what this person looked like. And there is, right, there's a documentary, I think, on YouTube where it's it's not a documentary. It's like a dramatization, basically, of yes. Bob Berdella's life. That's what it is. And that's the opening scene is this guy, like, jumping from the second story onto the roof, jumping down. And, like, just trigger warning when you see the backside of this person, because it is rough.
Yeah, definitely. We'll talk a little bit about that in this next section, actually.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about the investigation. Though Officer Cole had his doubts about the validity of Bryson's story, Officer Tom Moss, who was the second police officer to arrive, would recognize the name Bob Berdella from an open missing persons case that he had been investigating, in which Bob had been the last to see, or the last person known to see, a different young man before his disappearance. So Bob Berdella sounded familiar to the second officer who arrived on the scene because he had been a witness in this person's missing persons case. Mm. All right. Law enforcement would request a search warrant of the property at 4315 Charlotte Street, which of course was Bob's house, and a full-blown investigation into the life and possible crimes of Bob Berdella would then ensue. The findings would soon portray Bob as something vastly different from the aforementioned helpful, civic-minded neighbor and watchman, or the mentor and counselor of the city's most troubled young men. An area of Kansas City known as 10th and McGee had a 20-year history within the community as being an area where homosexual men would go to meet other men who were interested in having casual sex or to seek out the services of male sex workers. So it was a cruising spot. Bob Berdella was no stranger to 10th and McGee, and the men who frequented the area were no stranger to Bob. Investigators would discover that Bob had a reputation for drugging the men that he would pick up in the area of 10th and McGee, holding them captive for a period of time, and engaging in painful, aggressive sex with them, often sodomizing them with vegetables, with his fists, and torturing them in other ways.
How do you get a reputation for that? Like, how does it happen so much that, like, people just know that you're the kind of guy that does that, and you're still getting people to go with you?
Well, I think the reason it was able to persist as long as it was is, of course,
maybe they weren't talking about it.
They were talking to each other about it a little bit, but they're not reporting these crimes because like, who's going to care? Because they're gay men.
Like, let's warn each other. But
exactly.
Not,
they're gay men. They're sex workers. They feel as though they're not going to be taken seriously by any law enforcement agency. And maybe they feel like they're going to be in more trouble if they go to the police than Bob Berdella would have been.
That's a very, and, I mean, you're not wrong. Yeah. That's exactly how I would probably feel. Yeah, I get that. Mm-hmm.
And consider that he has this reputation of being this upstanding, civic-minded, like, person within the community. And
everybody knows him. Everybody loves him. Exactly. No one would believe that he does this kind
exactly.
of thing.
And it's his word against the word of somebody who's maybe whose life isn't considered as valuable.
Well, he was raised in the Catholic Church, so he understands that.
He does. All right. So let's talk about Bob's medical records. Reviewing Bob's medical records, because this, of course, is part of the investigation, authorities would discover that he had been hospitalized 2 to 3 different times after having the head of his penis bitten off. And that was per Dr. Marilyn Richardson, who was in the documentary that I watched, where I got most of this information.
Sorry, I'm having a moment.
No. It's cringeworthy for sure. All right, so search of Bob's home. Let's talk about that.
Yes.
Search of Bob's home would reveal via luminol testing that the floors of his basement and surfaces all throughout the upstairs bathroom were excessively stained with human blood. Additionally, Bob would have ties not only to one, but actually 2 open missing persons cases. They were the disappearances of 2 young men, Jerry Howell and James Ferris, both of whom would have personal belongings found inside Bob Berdella's home. Finally, a human skull was found buried in the backyard, and that would later be identified as Larry Pearson, a young man who was featured in Bob Berdella's torture log, which they also discovered. This was a detailed account of how Bob Berdella tortured, raped, and eventually killed several of his victims.
I forgot about the torture log.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot about that, too. That's this guy, man, he just had so many things just wrapped up in his, like, I don't even know, his MO, I guess.
It was very specific, the things that he would do. They, of course, find all of this evidence that human biological material, like, existed, like blood and other things. But they find this torture log where he kept very specific details of the things that he had done to people.
Yeah.
And accompanying the torture log, even, there were Polaroid photos
That's right.
of his victims. 23, I think, is what they stated even looked dead in these photographs.
Well, and I guess that's just what they did before, you know, the internet sites existed where you would put things like that, you know, that we've learned in the 2000s, like Luca Magnotta, you know, things like that. They didn't have that option. So you just have it on your own person all the time.
And of course, we've known a lot of serial killers and a lot of people who perpetrate these, to perpetrate these sort of crimes to keep trophies. So these were his trophies, so to speak. No other physical evidence, i.e. remains, would be discovered in any of these cases. Bob would confess that after murdering his victims, he would drain the bodies of blood and dismember them with chainsaws, hacksaws, cooking knives, et cetera, before placing the remainder of the victims or replacing their body parts in black plastic bags and sitting them out on the curb to be taken away to the local landfill.
Just put it out with the trash.
Yeah, just put it out with the trash. Many would speculate, however, that Bob was too meticulous and too calculated in his crimes to risk sanitation workers discovering the remains and suggest that he disposed of his victims by other means. Theories of law enforcement and local community would include the following, but could never be substantiated or confirmed. They would suspect that the novelty skulls and bone jewelry sold at Bob's Bazaar Bazaar was neither novelty nor imported, but... they suspected that it came from his victims.
Uh-huh.
All right. There was also the fact that Bob's house came equipped with an oversized industrial garbage disposal in the kitchen, the type that would often be found in places such as hospitals and laboratories that were used to dispose of human biological material.
Yeah.
Oh. And speaking of Bob's kitchen, it was speculated that he would utilize his skills and experience as a chef to dispose of the victim's remains. An example of this would include the proprietors of the Westport Flea Market would often have potluck lunches. The participants would later report that they always thought that Bob's chili tasted funny. All right, so what happened? What happened?
Mm-hmm.
With all the physical and circumstantial evidence obtained by the task force that was investigating Bob Rodella and his crimes, on July 22nd of 1988, a grand jury would formally indict him for the first-degree murder of Larry Pearson. Now, they started with that charge because that was the one that they could kind of prove because they found his skull buried in the backyard. They found photos of him, and he was featured in the torture log. So they knew that they could at least charge him with that. Under the advisement of his counsel, in order to escape the death penalty, Bob would enter a guilty plea that same day because at that time, under Missouri law, if a perpetrator pled guilty to first-degree murder charge, they would receive an automatic life sentence without the possibility of parole. Judge Alvin Randall accepted Bob's guilty plea with the insistence that he confess under oath in great detail to the crime. On August 24th of 1988, Bob would earn another life sentence plus 7 years for pleading guilty to charges associated with forced sodomy and felonious restraint. And that was, of course, Christopher Bryson, the gentleman who had escaped and kind of told the world, hey, this is a bad dude.
Right.
Then on September 13th of 1988, in exchange for 5 additional life sentences, Bob accepted a plea deal to give detailed confessions of each crime under oath in order to abolish any pursuit of the death penalty. So essentially, this man who had absolutely no problem taking other people's lives valued his own life enough that he said, hey, guys, I'm going to do all of these things in order to avoid the death penalty as much as I can. As a matter of fact, let me tell you about everything that I did, all this sick, twisted shit, as long as you promise me that you're not going to try to
do the same thing to me.
Do the same thing to me, exactly. So that you promise me that you're not going to try to sentence me to death.
Yeah, so like you understand the weight or the gravity of death. Like,
exactly.
No.
Exactly. All right. So the confessions would formally take place on December 13th and December 15th of 1988. His victims were 19-year-old Jerry Howell. Some of these names we will already have discussed, but I felt like all of these victims deserve to have at least their names mentioned specifically. Victims were 19-year-old Jerry Howell, 23-year-old Robert Sheldon, 20-year-old Mark Wallace, 20-year-old James Ferris, 21-year-old Todd Stoops, 20-year-old Larry Pearson, and of course, the final victim who we've already mentioned, the one who did survive, 22-year-old Christopher Bryson. Those present would later say that during the various accounts of how he kidnapped, raped, tortured, killed, dismembered, and disposed of these six young men between 1984 and 1988, Bob Berdella showed no remorse or any degree of humanity for the crimes that he had committed.
He's sounding like very GSK, like Golden State Killer now to me. Now that Golden State has been sentenced and I've seen all of that, because it's just making me think of, I was listening to another podcast talking, Paul Holes was talking about the sentencing and stuff. And the thing that they were bringing up was, I don't remember who it was, but I think someone on the defense side had like three sheets of paper, right? And they were completely blank. So she crumpled one up, or she had like the main sheet. And she said, this is like a person's life that has life ahead of them. No sexual assault, no abuse, no nothing. And then she takes another piece of paper and she crumples it up. And she's like, this is someone who has been sexually assaulted and murdered. And now they're completely gone. There is nothing left. Throw it away. And then she takes the third piece and she crumples it up and she unfolds it. And the creases in there are supposed to signify all of the mental trauma and everything else that comes along with being a sexual assault victim. So now this Bryson, he has to live forever with 4 days of horrible torture. Like, how do you recover from that? You know,
I can't even fathom
that poor guy.
Yeah. I hope he has gotten and is continuing to get all the appropriate help that he needs.
At that, you know, thank you for being strong enough to stand up, you know,
brave enough,
instead of just like running away and being like, I'm just going to stay away from him forever.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine how many lives he saved just by, like you said, not just running off with his own freedom and his own life, but being brave enough to say, hey, this happened. This is a bad person.
And we need to stop it.
We need to stop this.
Yeah.
You're absolutely correct.
Sorry, on a tangent, but I was thinking of that scene the whole time. And I loved hearing that they did that in court. You know, it resonated in a way.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely fine. They said that he showed no remorse or no degree of humanity for his crimes. Oh, and I did want to say that since you mentioned what kind of vibes that you were getting, I, in looking back over this research and the notes that I had made originally, I was getting such Gacy / Dahmer vibes.
Yes.
It's like a perfect combination of the two of them almost. But of course, everybody knows about Gacy and everybody knows about Dahmer because there was a trial.
We've talked about that before too. Just like everybody knows about Golden State because he just had a trial.
Exactly.
You know, it's been publicized for so long, but
he confessed.
Yeah.
There was no trial, so it wasn't like heavily sensationalized.
Well, it was in a way, right?
At least, yeah, exactly. At least outside of the local media, not a lot of people knew about it. So that's why this is literally like the Gacy or the Dahmer that most people have never heard of.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, a little, like as far as torture goes, I mean, a little worse. I think that's why I always thought of BTK, because he did like the bind them, torture them. You know what I mean? Whereas like, I feel like Gacy did a couple magic tricks and...
Yeah.
But either way, like, I'm not saying that. I'm not taking anything away from the horrifying things that Gacy did. I'm just saying this guy is... I feel like more people should know about him because of how horrific it is.
So he showed no remorse, no degree of humanity. I know I've said that three times,
but I just want to illustrate it.
And really no ownership of the crimes that he had committed, even going so far as to pose questions like, why was I able to get away with this for so long? Why didn't someone stop me? Why didn't someone catch me? Suggesting that law enforcement was somehow responsible for the things that he did. And we've heard that before. It's very Eileen Wuornos, right?
It is.
Yeah, and probably other ones, but we know about Eileen specifically because we've covered her a couple of times now.
Yes, we have.
All right, so as fate would have it, Bob Berdella would only serve 5 years of his 7 life sentences plus 7 years of incarceration, which he was imprisoned at the Missouri State, Missouri State Penitentiary. On October 8th of 1992, at about 2 p.m., Bob would begin to complain of chest pain and be taken to the facility's infirmary. An ambulance would be called, so I always have to shout out the EMTs and paramedics. We love you, Queens. We love EMS folks.
We do.
And he would be transported to a hospital in Columbia, Missouri, where he would ultimately suffer cardiac arrest and be pronounced dead at 3:55 p.m. on that date. Bob Berdella was 43 years old.
It's not fair.
He absolutely... Well, Okay, so I have two kind of opinions because, you know me, I'm all over the place with how I feel about something.
Sure.
I have multiple opinions about the exact same thing.
Oh, me too. That's why it works so well.
So I love the irony behind the fact that he did everything he could to avoid the death penalty because he was in such fear of his own mortality and his own death. Mm-hmm. So I love the fact that, as fate would have it, He lost his life 5 years later anyway, piece of shit, which probably...
You didn't even get to live for 20.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it also is unfair that I do agree. The other side of my brain says he should have suffered...
Way more
than this. Mm-hmm. He should have suffered for 50 years.
And we know that he probably would have in prison, just based on what we at least know a little about prison.
Yeah. Okay, so that actually is the story of Bob Rodella and his crimes, his sentencing, and his death, which is all horrific, all terrible, and we do want more people to know this story and to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But you and I think have both, in just general discussion about this case when we weren't recording a podcast, talked about how the thing that we almost found more offensive than all of that was the community's response.
Absolutely.
To all of these things. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. Get ready to get pissed.
Exactly. Get ready to get pissed. So we'll start with the negative because there is a tiny bit of positive here, but we're definitely going to start with the negative. Starting with the negative, speaking about the aftermath of the Kansas City Butcher saga, Reverend Roger Coleman would be quoted as saying the community was, quote, not outraged. They seemed to place less value on the lives of these victims, and not a lot of seriousness was attached to the actual crimes. That's the reverend who actually counseled Bob Rodella and counseled some of the people who were involved in the investigation, counseled some of the families. He essentially said people didn't care about these people, about these lives specifically, and people didn't place a lot of importance on these crimes.
Yeah.
They didn't think it was that severe because of the population of people that were affected.
Sure. It's like, oh, you mean sex workers got killed? Meh. Okay.
Oh, you mean
good riddance.
Yeah. You mean gay men got killed?
Yeah.
Meh. I'm sure they deserved it. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the response.
What were they wearing that night?
Exactly. Victim blaming. You were 1000% correct. The local gay community would suggest that law enforcement did not prioritize the disappearances of these young men over the years due to their sexuality, their livelihood or their work as sex workers, or struggles that these people had with alcoholism or drug addiction. Police would, of course, deny these allegations, citing lack of missing persons reports or leads in these cases, which actually is a fair argument if you consider the fact that a lot of these people didn't have a full-time residence or they were estranged from their families, or considering what we were kind of talking about earlier, the fact that the sex worker community or even the gay community wasn't necessarily coming forward and reporting these people as missing because they were afraid of how that would affect them negatively.
Absolutely.
So it's a fair argument to say we can't look for someone that we don't know is missing.
That, someone that doesn't have a home address.
Exactly.
You know?
If we have no leads in a case, how are we...
Where are they supposed to be?
Exactly. We can't even begin an investigation. So that's a fair point and a fair argument. Do I believe that they didn't prioritize these cases of these sex workers and these alcoholics and these drug addicts and these gay men that they did know about? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. How many deadheads have gone missing in the 70s? People are just they probably just wandered off somewhere.
There's a new podcast about that, actually.
Is there really?
I think it's called Dead and Gone. It's by Payne Lindsay.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I've been very intrigued by that whole thing lately,
yeah,
and I don't know why. Okay.
And, of course, these are the things that are the most disgusting to me. Two local radio stations would throw parties encouraging people to show up wearing dog collars attached to leashes. The Fox radio station even awarded prizes to people who would show up to their studios and have their pictures taken wearing dog collars attached to leashes.
I'm going to tell you, this was way easier to take when I was drunk versus hungover this time. the first go around, I was on wine. This today, I'm very hungover and my stomach hurts.
A radio disc jockey named Skid Rody would even compose a spoof song to the tune of the song They Call Me Mellow Yellow called They Call Me Bob Rodello.
I told you I wanted you to do this. I just wanted you to do that again.
And it, of course, was mocking and making fun of the crimes and the victims.
Who writes a song about him?
Oh, he's not the only one. A band called The Demon Dogs wrote a song called The Bob Rodella Ballad. And also the locals, so people local to Kansas City, would even go so far as to memorialize the house at 4315 Charlotte Street by stopping by with cameras to take photos of one another, pretending to escape the house, pretending to be the victims who had to escape from the house.
That's so awful. And you can see pictures of it too.
You can find these photos online.
They're not like taken off the internet. Like they still exist, right?
And it just all just disgusts me because, I mean, I understand this happened in like the late 80s, early 90s. And I understand like prejudices, and I understand that, I mean, this is technically the Midwest still, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I understand the small-mindedness but I'm just still completely disgusted by
Absolutely.
It because I have to believe 1000% that if all of these victims had been women, the community response would have been very different.
Oh, absolutely.
Or if the victims had been heterosexual men, mm-hmm. the community's response would have been very different. Mm-hmm. Or God forbid, if the victims had been children, people would have responded very differently. But because these were gay men or sex workers or people who maybe lived a very different lifestyle than what's considered air quotes normal in the Midwest, people literally made fun of these crimes. And that is disgusting.
I was going to add in one too. Like if they were all cops, do you know what would have happened?
Ooh, yeah.
You know what war would ensue, like against the public?
Fucking civil war, man.
Honestly.
Yeah. And even kind of more disheartening, I did watch a documentary where I got a lot of information. It was something that I found on YouTube. In that documentary, which was filmed in 2003 or 2004, so not that long ago, definitely not the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah, I think I watched that one too, right?
Mm-hmm. They did a shot of graffiti inside a men's room.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. the shot was of graffiti that specifically said, "Bob Berdella died for your sins, cocksuckers."
Yeah.
I mean,
so Bob Berdella died because you guys are a bunch of sinners, you faggots, basically.
Exactly.
Like, that's horrible. That's exactly. But that's what you're saying. And it's even worse because you're using, like, cocksuckers? Who says that? What are you, nine? Ugh.
No. What are we in, middle school?
Like, seriously.
Yeah. It's like calling somebody a milky liquor. And that one always stands out with me when I consider.
Horrible.
Yeah. Whenever I consider young kids mm-hmm. bullying other young kids about
wrong.
Being gay or queer in some sort of way, because I have a very clear memory of that being yelled at me as I was walking like home from school one day by kids that I went to school with.
That's disgusting.
It is. It's horrible. But let's end on a slightly positive note.
Slightly.
With regard to this. A local millionaire by the name of Del Dunmire, who was known to be a very eccentric man in the Kansas City, Missouri area, actually bought Bob Berdella's former home, the home that the locals were memorializing, making fun of, like taking photos in front of, essentially making it like a local like landmark that they seemingly were proud of.
Mm-hmm.
He actually bought the home, had it demolished, and donated that land to the city.
Amazing.
So thank you, Del Dunmire.
I remember. Thank you, Del. We love you.
We love you. And that is the story of Bob Berdella, the Kansas City Butcher, and how Kansas City, at least at that point in time, responded to these horrible crimes.
I at least want to applaud that person and the city for how they handled it. Because if there's, I mean, how much more justice can you get? The guy's gone. He was put away. And now that is not in existence anymore. Thank goodness for that person.
Yeah.
So
snaps.
Snaps.
And I think it's time to take a quick break.
And then I'll tell a story.
Let's do it. And we're back again.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
All right. So it's my turn to tell this story. Now, like I said, the way it was described before, right? They gave the person's dead name. So we took that first name off because we're not going to do that. However, like in your notes, you have how to pronounce this person's name. And it says, so it's in my head, I thought it was Beat because it's B-E-A-T-E. So I'm thinking the whole time, like, I'm going to talk about Beat Schmidt. And then I'm like, open up and I'm like, okay, let's start reading about this. And I see your notes that say, yes, like Beyonce, but not. And it's like B-E-Y-A-H-T-A-H. And I'm like sitting in my bed. I'm like, Beata.
Beata.
Beata-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Like, what is this name? And I was just having a moment. But yeah, so Beata.
Beata.
Beata. Beata Schmidt. The pink giant or the beast of Bielitz. So we'll talk about the early years to begin. Beata, yes, like Beyonce, but not. Schmidt was born on October 5th, 1966 in a municipality called Lehnen, Germany, which is in the German state of Brandenburg, about 24 kilometers southwest of Potsdam. Those close to Schmidt would advise that though born biologically male, the child always wanted to be female. At an early age, Schmidt would begin dressing up like her mother in her mother's clothes, despite the fact that each time she would receive harsh punishments. Schmidt would later go on record as describing her mother as a cold-hearted woman, which I think we get that already, right?
Yeah.
By the age of 7, Schmidt was sneaking and wearing her mother's underwear before masturbating and urinating in them. So we add that in, even though it's hard to say, because we're like starting to see that nod to the McDonald's triad, you know, and mommy issuesness.
I wasn't even trying to combine mommy issuesness with daddy issuesness.
I totally thought that too. I'm like, that wasn't even on purpose. Which, you know, it could be daddy too, because like, obviously he's mad at mom. Like, where's dad, you know? For those who may not be familiar with the McDonald triad, it's the three factors, you know, that are two or more are present in someone's childhood. You're kind of like, okay, like arson, I think, is one. The animal, hurting animals.
Yeah.
Obviously, what we've just mentioned, things like that, you know, you kind of start noticing. So yeah, we'll just kind of fast forward to the crimes. On October 24th, 1989, Beata Schmidt would commit her first known murder at the age of 23. A 51-year-old housewife named Adeltraud Nixdorf.
Sure.
I literally wrote here, I'm like, okay, Wayne's just fucking with me now.
So, I think it's Adeltraud.
Adeltraud. Okay. Adeltraud Nixdorf, which I'm like, okay, I get the last name. Yes. Was planting tulips in her front yard when Schmidt approached the woman, beat and strangled her to death before raping her dead body. Due to the brutality of this crime, the sexual assault of the body, and the fact that the partner seems to always have the first suspect, like...
Well, they always suspect the husband or the partner or the romantic partner first.
It's always going to be someone that you know, basically, that's close to you. Let's see. Investigators believe that the perpetrator would be the husband, obviously, the woman's husband.
Yeah.
But it did not have any sufficient evidence to convict him for obvious reasons in hindsight. The man would commit suicide the following year via ingesting or poisoning himself with pesticides.
So,
which, it's just this story of like, okay, well, you've been accused of murdering your wife. First of all, your wife's gone.
Exactly. You're mourning that loss.
And then people are saying it's you. And how do you take that? I don't think I would take that very well either. On May 24th, 1990, Schmidt would beat, rape, and ultimately kill a 55-year-old woman named Krista Najooks.
Sure.
When she placed a cord around her neck, strangling her. Her body would be found located in a junkyard the following day. The victim would be found with pink woman's underwear that were identified as having not belonged to her. So that's an interesting little, like, why?
Yeah.
Maybe you just kept hers and wanted to cover her.
Maybe that's like a calling card of sorts.
Could be.
Yeah.
But in a junkyard, man, like, I just don't understand just throwing people out with the trash.
It maybe speaks to your psyche and how you view that person or how you view and value human life in general.
Yeah. And this is a 55-year-old woman. Like, okay. So the next one, on March 13th, 1991, Schmidt would beat, rape, and stab to death a 34-year-old Inge Fischer in the woods of Inbelitz. Again, so she's kind of always in the same area. Her remains would be located approximately a week later. After that, we have what we believe is the saddest case. On March 22nd, 1991, a 44-year-old Tamara Padrowskaja was taking a walk through the woods near a Russian military hospital where her husband worked. She was with her 3-month-old son, who was in a stroller. Like, this mom's pushing her little baby around. When the two were approached by Schmidt, she would attack the two, killing the child before gagging Tamara with her bra, raping her, and strangling her to death. The only thing I can say about that is at least, like, that 3-month-old didn't have to witness. I mean, I know only 3 months, but, like, imagine that being, like, the one thing that you have before you leave this earth, you know? At least you were that decent. I don't know. 14 days later, on April 5th, 1991, Schmidt would attempt to abduct 2 12-year-old girls at knife point, which is... 12-year-old girls, like, that's so... It was usually, like, older women. And then maybe... What's that about?
The victim profile, I remember about this case, really did start out consistently with what seemed to be like elderly women or women who were kind of later in life or advanced in years, you know, like 50s, whatnot. And then it just kind of slowly seemed to peak down because you went from like, what, like 60s to 50s to like 30s and then just 12.
Yeah.
So since there was no like real like victim profile, or the victim profile seemed to change so much, maybe these were just victims of opportunity.
It could be. Or once she murdered a child, it was like, oh, I can do that. Like,
yeah,
I'm okay with that. Yeah. I can do that.
She was evolving in her crimes.
And yes. Kind of learning more about herself in a way.
Yeah.
Okay. So the 12-year-old girls, she spotted them in the woods near Ludwigsfield. The girl would manage to fight Schmidt off and escape to the girls, both girls, I'm sorry, would manage to fight Schmidt off and escape to safety, giving investigators a detailed account of what happened and helping develop a composite sketch of the attacker, which would later be publicized by the local news outlets. So these girls, we have our saving grace a little bit. Like, they got out, they said, listen, this happened. And of course, they're going to be listened to. They're 12-year-old girls, right? The same day, however, Schmidt would enter the Spruce Forest home near Bielitz, I always do that wrong, of a 66-year-old woman. So we're back to kind of, this one's even older than the other ones, Talita Bremer. She would beat and strangle the woman to death before raping her. So there's still, we're back to what we were like before. And then the final one, I believe, on August 1st, the final one on August 1st, 1991, Schmidt would be apprehended when two men recognizing the composite sketch of her would discover Schmidt in the woods, masturbating with a bra. They grabbed her, like, just snatched her right up, like, coon coot, prune shootout, let's go. Yeah, they took her to the police themselves. So they just brought Donald Duck to the police station and said, this is who you're looking for. We got her. And I don't know, that's pretty badass. Like, you had in the notes, you're like, if that's not badass and idiotic, I don't know what it is.
I mean, it was definitely one of those two things, likely both.
Yeah, they're like, let's just apprehend this girl. Like, we're not going to be able to find her again is probably the mentality. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we see her, let's get her because we're two guys and we can do it, you know?
Yeah, this is definitely the perpetrator.
She's also compromised, right? In a way that she's got her pants down. Like, you know that if she has a weapon, she's not going to be able to grab it before you get to her. So
she's compromised. She's distracted. They definitely have the advantage in the situation. Uh-huh. There's two of them versus one of her. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It was, I mean, snaps.
Snaps to that.
Okay, so now we'll just go ahead to the sentencing. For the murder of five women and 1 3-month-old child, Beata Schmidt would serve a 15-year prison sentence. And
please.
Attention, the bullshit meter has detected major BS. Confirmed, that's definitely some bullshit.
I cannot even imagine.
Yeah. So that's when she would be placed in a state-run mental institution, of which she is quoted as saying, I never want to leave. In 2001, her name would legally change to Beata and begin gender reassignment therapy in 2009. The only further reports that we really have regarding her is that in 2010, she would rape a fellow inmate, which was a transgender inmate of her institution, resulting in that person committing suicide. And all I said at the very end of that was, what a fucking tornado of a human.
I agree.
Like, you just came to fuck shit up wherever you were. And like, I don't know what that's about. And I feel for you in a way, because I'm sure childhood has something to do with it. But goddamn.
Yeah. I have no concept of what it's like to live with gender dysphoria and what it's like to be punished for having that or living with that and trying to express that in a way. I have no concept of what that's like and what that would do to a person's psyche.
Sure.
I really don't. But just because you were victimized in some sort of way does not give you the right to go out and commit such horrific crimes and victimize most everyone that you encounter in your life. And that's, for me, what this kind of seems like, because we had discussed like victims of opportunity, maybe like a light, like, victim profile that, you know, with like the mommy issues and whatnot.
Yeah. But
even with
older women
even just the cellmate of the institution, like that was very obviously a victim of opportunity, because that's probably the only person you have like close access to.
That's fair.
Close contact with.
You're probably in the same just wing together, you know?
Train wreck of a human being.
Absolutely. And okay, so like on your point when it comes to trauma, and that's something that they talk a lot about when it comes to these cases from that docuseries that I brought up at the very beginning, is for instance, when I watch docuseries, and I know they're all going to be different, I don't watch them in order. I choose based on like what they're going to be about. And there's one in particular that it's misleading. The paragraph says it was a group of three teens that burned a man alive because he was like basically a neighborhood pedophile, right?
Okay.
So when you read that, you're like, I don't really know if I feel like they should be in jail still. Like they were teenagers. They probably were victims themselves. So yeah, no, it's not okay to burn someone alive, but like, it's like one of those, like, can you blame them? But then when you really get down and you get into it, you're like, oh no, 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 that's not what this was. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, it's case by case, right?
Yeah.
Especially for kids.
Yeah. It's sort of,
but this is a grown woman.
Yeah. This is a grown woman who, rather than seeking opportunities to victimize other people and literally take lives, should have used that time, energy, effort, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to find help for herself.
Mm-hmm. And it seems as though, you know, she almost got help after being in prison for 15 years, right? It was, I never want to leave. I'm getting my reassignment surgery. I'm just, you probably feel more like yourself than you ever have. And then it's like, you can't stop.
Yeah.
It's like a compulsion.
Yeah. So
compulsion, right?
Compulsion. Word? No, I think so.
Yeah. So that's the story. A short one, but you know, Bob Berdella is such a long story.
Bob Berdella is pretty long. Yeah. And that's part of the reason. Yeah. Part of the reason we combined these two, because they were stories that we had told before, but people don't necessarily have access to. And Bob's a pretty long winded story. Whereas Beata, there's not a ton of information out there about her. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that the story's told. But
yes. And I extremely apologize for the pronunciation of those names. I looked up all of them, but I'm terrible at that. So I'm very sorry for that. But the story itself, I mean, I feel like as long as we get the story out there, then we're kind of doing our job, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it makes you, we
human.
Often, yeah. And we also, with regard to this story specifically, we often wonder or discuss whether or not we feel like certain people turn to these horrific crimes or these, this life of crime based on influences that were nature versus nurture. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And for this one, it definitely feels like a nurture sort of situation.
Totally.
Imagine how different this person's life could have been and how these other lives could have been saved if she had had a loving, supportive mother.
Who didn't beat her when she wore her clothes. Yeah. Like, I mean, I know family members that were men that are completely straight now that as children, that they just wanted to do what mom was doing because they hung out with mom all the time.
Exactly.
Like, that's fine. Just let them do it and maybe it's a phase, maybe it's not. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
As long as they're happy.
As long as they're happy and they're being their true, authentic selves and they're not going out and killing innocent people.
Exactly. But yeah, that was the story. Those are our stories.
And that's a nice segue, I think, into
the mic drop.
The mic drop.
I feel like we got to bring that back since we're vintage.
Yeah, so exactly. Yes. This is retro Slay Queens.
Yes.
All right. So thank you all for listening to these stories. We hope that you enjoyed them.
Yes.
If you did.
I enjoyed them.
These are good stories. Mm-hmm. If you enjoyed them, please talk about it, post about it, like about it.
All the things.
All the things. All the good things. You can find us. We are Slay Queens Pod. Where can they find us?
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We have our Patreon now with our lovely followers.
Yes.
Loving that. Please come support. Love us.
Yes.
We love you.
Do all the good things. We love you. So please love us in return. Please.
Please. I can't stand rejection.
Love us back. Yes. But you can find us on all the streaming platforms, on essentially all the social medias, and you can email us at slayqueenspod@gmail.com.
That's correct.
We hope that you have, I don't know. What do we hope?
We hope you had a great Halloween, since we did bring up Halloween.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be after.
I was thinking, okay, Halloween. No, that's going to be done by now. We hope that you voted. Wait.
Yeah.
But of course, this is going to be after.
Will it be the day after?
This will be the week after.
The week after. Okay, yeah. That's right.
We hope that you did vote.
Yes.
And we hope that it was a good outcome.
I know.
You should know by now.
We're praying.
But mostly, we hope that you will
go out and slay, queens.
Just not each other.
I'm going away, but I won't come back on a lonesome railroad line. But I can't forget that sweet little girl who sleeps in the pines and the pines.